You're listening to Sipping on Some Crime podcast, hosted by Aaron. This podcast covers sensitive and triggering subjects, explicit language, and mature content which may not be suitable for children. As always, all parties are innocent until proven guilty.
I know it has been a minute since I did the podcast, and for those that have been here for quite a few years, welcome. For those of you that are new, hello. We are doing something different. I could not record where I live. I still can't record where I live. It is too noisy. It is too loud. And every one of these cases, when it comes to podcast form, deserves the best audio quality. So I did what any creative person does. I pivoted. And I created a series called 50 State Cold Case Spotlight, which is on YouTube and TikTok. And I am now collecting those videos and putting them into audio files and then bringing them here to you. I cover 5 cases in a state each week, and I'm already up to the 20th week and the 20th state on YouTube and TikTok. So hopefully I can get these audio formatted quickly as possible and start bringing them to you weekly as well. And we're going to start with my home state, Maryland. Just a quick reference note that you will hear terms like SA, which stands for sexual assault, because in the beginning of my videos on TikTok, it was set to be flagged for certain words. So I was very careful to make sure that the videos didn't get taken down. But as I continued to record, I started using those words again. So my apologies. Things like SA mean sexual assault. So there might be some abbreviations or talking around certain words. But again, like I said, that does change in the later episodes. This is one of those cases that have very little information, but it is worthy of the spotlight. So let's dive in. March 13th, 1979, Timothy Grant and Goldie Fritz were a young couple enjoying each other's company when they parked at a remote area near the Potomac River in Washington County, Maryland. They were sitting in the cab of Timothy's truck when around 10 p.m., a gunman approached them and ordered Timothy to step out of the cab. The gunman told Timothy to lie on the ground face down as he rummaged through Timothy's pockets. The gunman ended up taking cash from Timothy and then ordered Timothy to walk towards the river. The gunman then told Timothy he better start swimming or he'd be shot. Timothy told investigators that when he entered the river, Goldie was still in the truck cab. Troopers estimated that the stretch of river that Timothy entered was about 200 yards wide, and the other side reached the West Virginia shore banks. Timothy swam across the river, climbing out on the West Virginia side, and began knocking on doors that evening, trying to find someone to help him call the police. Eventually, someone answered and called in the troopers. Troopers arrived at the scene. They did still find Timothy's truck parked where he said it would be, but Goldie was no longer in the cab. Troopers would search the area. They would find Goldie in the river several feet from the shore. Troopers believe she drowned by either being forced to swim in the river like Timothy by the gunman or attempting to flee and escape the gunman. The autopsy of Goldie would show that there was no attempts of violence to her body. Witnesses told investigators that they had seen a two-tone green Pontiac near the scene that night. There is no description of the gunman in the news articles or circulated by investigators. There's also no details about whether Goldie knew how to swim. There's very little to go on here, but Goldie deserves justice. If you believe you have information in Goldie's case, you can call the Metro Crime Stoppers at 1-866-7-LOCKUP. Thank you for taking the time to get to know Goldie today. Today, I will be covering the case of Cherie Magaro. Cherie would last be seen leaving her fiancé's home in Kennedyville, Maryland. The following day, investigators would be called in on an abandoned car report, which quickly turned into a homicide investigation. Cherie's case still remains unsolved 38 years later. Cherie Maria Magaro, 30, worked as a secretary with the Control Data Corp, a lottery machine manufacturer, and was considered a great employee. Before becoming a secretary and right out of high school, she taught modeling. She was married in 1982 and divorced 3 years later, and her ex-husband shared a 4-year-old son at the time of her disappearance. There's a few discrepancies in the articles online that I would like to clear up in Cherie's case. Cherie is said to be in the Kentmore area in a lot of articles and some in the Kennedyville area. If we go back to the archives, it actually states that she left from Kennedyville. So that's what we are going with. Any articles that refer to the person's house that she was at as a friend, a boyfriend, or a fiancé. Back to the original archived articles, we find that boyfriend and fiancé are the two most mentioned, with fiancé being in the runner, so that is the one we are going to go with. Now that we cleared up all those messy discrepancies, let's jump back into Cherie's case. February 22nd, 1987, Cherie says goodbye to her fiancé at his Kennedyville home. Cherie would get into her gray four-door 1976 Ford Torino with the intent of driving back home to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. There was a major snowstorm coming that night, and Cherie wanted to leave to get ahead of the accumulation. Maryland would end up getting 15 to 18 inches of snow total in some areas. The road in and out of Kennedyville is a single-lane highway with stretches of farmland and truly nobody around. It is quite a desolate area. Cherie would never make it home to Pennsylvania that night, and her car would be discovered around 9:45 a.m. the following morning after someone anonymously called the police to report that a vehicle was in a field west of State Route 213 north of Cecilton. Investigators were able to determine that Cherie's vehicle must have been left there between 10:15 and 10:45 p.m. the previous night because the snow in the field was 16 to 18 inches deep, but only 1 inch deep under Cherie's car. Investigators noted that there was clothing scattered around her vehicle, which seemed to be in good running condition, with 7 gallons of gas in the tank. Upon closer inspection, investigators found hair, blood, and human tissue inside the partially burned interior of the vehicle. Investigators didn't find any blood outside of the vehicle on the ground. However, Cherie's driver's license, a tube of lipstick, and her purse were on the ground about 100 yards away from her vehicle. And in her purse were several expensive jewelry pieces. Investigators would speak with a witness that reported seeing a Ford Mustang with a Maryland license plate in the field with Cherie's car that night and their hazard lights on. Investigators say, based on the shape and type of hazard lights reported by the witness, a Mustang would only be a model in the years of 1974, 1978, 1983, and 1987. Another witness saw a man standing next to Cherie's car, and a woman that resembled Cherie was seen talking to this man, described as around 25 to 30 years old, about 5'10", around 170 pounds, dark hair, brown eyes, and a mustache. During a more comprehensive search of the area, investigators found a blood-stained male's plaid shirt found on Route 213 just a few miles from where Cherie's car was located. DNA tests would later confirm that that was Cherie's blood. On February 23rd, the same day that Cherie's vehicle is discovered in the cornfield in Cecilton around 9:45 a.m., at about 11 a.m. in Bel Air, Maryland, a man walks into a Sears store and attempts to use Cherie's Sears card. The store clerk ends up having to check something with the card, and that is when the man flees the store. The clerk said she really didn't think much about this interaction until she went home that night and saw the news coverage about Cherie, and that's when she called the investigators to let them know that a man came into Sears attempting to use Cherie's Sears credit card. Investigators would take the store clerk's statement and they create a composite sketch which closely matches the description of the man seen at Cherie's car the night before with the Mustang. The store clerk describes the man in his 20s, a white male with a darker complexion, a smooth face, and blue-green eyes, around 5'9 and 160 pounds with black hair. He is wearing army dark pants and a leather jacket. Investigators do send divers to search the Bohemian River Bridge area since the blood-stained shirt was found so close to that area. But unfortunately, divers do not find anything to bring them closer to finding Cherie. Investigators do believe that Cherie was murdered that night and that she died of blunt force trauma, but her remains have never been found. Cherie is a Caucasian female with brown hair and brown eyes. She drove a gray four-door 1976 Ford Torino, and investigators are still trying to solve her case. If you have any information in Cherie's case, please call the Maryland State Police at 410-290-0500. The case I'm covering today is out of the Maryland Cold Case Database, and it has very little information. I cannot find any pictures online of the couple, and I found one news article covering it in the archives. Sarah, 58, and Carvel Faulkner, 60, lived in Ellicott City, Maryland, and they owned and operated a local trash company. They ran their business out of their home, they were a quiet couple, and neighbors said they quite often hired youth from within the community. On April 25th, 1979, around 2:30 p.m., a foreman that worked for the couple's company stopped by the office, which was connected to the couple's home. When the foreman entered the office, it was empty. Carville had just recently had heart surgery and was supposed to be on bed rest, but the foreman expected to find Sarah there since she was the manager. When the foreman looked around the office and realized nobody was there, that's when he would enter the couple's home and find Sarah and Carvel's lifeless bodies in their bedroom. Carvel was dressed in his PJs and lying on the floor. He had suffered a fatal gunshot wound. Sarah was found in her work clothes lying next to Carvel with her hands and her feet bound, and she had suffered a fatal slit to the neck. Investigators believe that the motive was robbery, as items were missing from the residence. If you have any information in Sarah and Carvel's case, please call the Maryland State Police Homicide Unit at 410-653-4211. And on today's case, I'm going to be very careful and respectful with my terminology so that this case doesn't get taken down. In the early morning hours of September 26, 1989, the remains of a burned and tortured body would be found in Friendship Park, located in Glen Burnie, Maryland, close to the BWI airport. It wouldn't be long before they were able to identify the remains as Brenda Lorraine Bloom, 29, from Glen Burnie. The scene was brutal, and what Brenda endured before her death is unbearable to imagine. Brenda's mother, Betty, said that Brenda was a free spirit, fun, loving, and made friends very easily. She said that Brenda liked to have fun, she liked her friends, and she liked to drink a lot, but most of all, she really loved life. Brenda was married and a mother of three. Brenda was known to frequent bars in the Fort Meade area, and in her purse, she carried an address book containing over 200 names and numbers. You could say that Brenda never met a stranger. On September 25th of 1989, Brenda decided to stop at a bar near the intersection of Mountain Road on Maryland 100 around 7 p.m. Witnesses report that they saw Brenda leave on her own that night. Maryland police would say that Brenda was last seen walking in the area of Route 2 and Route 648 in Anne Arundel County sometime after 8 p.m. The following morning, September 26th, a woman walking her dog would discover Brenda's nude body on Sandy Road in Friendship Park off of Dorsey Road. Brenda had been stabbed multiple times and her body burned. There were also indications that Brenda had been essayed before her death. Investigators state that it looked like Brenda's body was dragged through multiple parts of the park in an attempt to display her. This led investigators to believe that this is not your conventional kidnapping, essaying, and killing. Corporal Rose said it wasn't a usual murder. They were looking for a guy who was ritualistic and psychotic. They don't believe that this was his first killing and that he does it the same way every time. Corporal Rose feared that there was now a murderer out on the loose that could strike again any time. At the scene where they discovered Brenda, her clothes were nowhere to be found. When the scene was discovered, investigators locked off the entire park for 2 days, canvassing every inch. Officers were even set in specific areas to crawl on their hands and knees, searching the ground for any evidence. They checked all the trash cans, they went through everything, and her clothes were never found. Investigators believe that the killer took them as a trophy. Investigators believe that they have a really good criminal profile of the killer. The only thing that they do not have is his identity. They spent over 110 hours that first week chasing down leads and Brenda's murder. On the year anniversary of Brenda's death, investigators scoped out Friendship Park and hoping the killer would return to the scene of the crime. But as far as they know, he didn't return on that anniversary. Investigators spoke with Brenda's relatives and her numerous friends and acquaintances several times throughout the years in hopes that it would lead to the killer. They had a few possible suspects. One in particular, they did spend time following around for a few months before they end up dismissing him as a suspect. Investigators did reach out to the state police and other counties asking if they had similar unsolved essay offenses or murders. Howard County found an unsolved essay offense that they believe could be related to Brenda's murder. On July 9th of 1985, in Scott's Cove, located in Rocky George State Park in Laurel, a 26-year-old Silver Spring woman was reading her book in the park when a man sat down beside her. When the woman tried to leave, the man grabbed her and tied her wrists together with twine. He then began to attempt to essay her, but instead cut off a chunk of her hair and left. That suspect was described as a white man between 30 and 35, 150 pounds, medium build, gray rotting teeth, light brown hair, parted on the left side. Investigators believe that if Howard County police are able to solve this attempted assault, it might bring them closer to their killer. When it comes to Brenda's case, investigators believe they were able to eliminate traditional motives in her murder, such as jealousy, money, and affairs. And they don't believe that she was killed by someone that she knew. They believe she was killed by a stranger. Every year after her daughter's death, Betty Duckworth would call the Maryland State Police for updates in her daughter's case. After Betty passed away, Brenda's sister Sarah stepped up in her mother's place and called the police each year for an update in Brenda's case. Sarah would pass away in 2024 of cancer, leaving her sister Lori Duckworth to continue to advocate for Brenda's case. Brenda's little sister Lori says they just want to find her killer and hold them accountable, and we can be a part of that by continuing to share her face and her story. If you believe you have information that can help solve Brenda Bloom's murder, please call the Maryland State Police at 410-996-7881. We are in Maryland. Today is day 5 and the last day of Maryland. Next week, we will be heading over to Rhode Island. So let's jump into the last case of this week. On November 13th of 1980, Deborah Ann Brooks, 17, and her little brother were hanging out in the living room just like they did most nights, waiting for their mother to return. Around 7 p.m., their mother Constance returned home from work with a prescription she had picked up for Deborah at the pharmacy on Monroe Street in Northwest D.C. Deborah noticed that her prescription had not been filled properly, and she told her mother she was going to go up to the drugstore and have them correct the prescription, and she knew she had to hurry because the drugstore would be closing soon. Paul, Deborah's little brother, who was very protective of his big sister, asked Deborah if he could go with her that night, but she said she wanted to stop by her boyfriend's house, and she said that she would just have Paul stay home. That night, Deborah was wearing blue jeans and a brown sweater, and she put on her green waist jacket and brown shoes and left her home shortly after 8 p.m. Paul said after Deborah left that night, he sat down on the couch to watch TV and fell asleep. When he woke up around 10:30 p.m., he noticed his mother pacing back and forth. Paul said he could tell that his mother was worried, and his mother told him that Deborah had not returned home, and she had already called the boyfriend's house, and they said that she had left earlier. And Deborah never stayed out past 10 or 10:30 p.m. on a school night. Paul said his mother would stay up that whole night looking for Deborah and spent that whole morning calling around trying to find her. When Paul got up the next morning, he got dressed and got ready for school, hoping to run into Deborah. His mother went ahead and got dressed and headed to work, hoping that she would hear from Deborah by the end of the day. Paul said Deborah wasn't at school when he arrived and he didn't see her throughout the entire day. And when he was on his way home from school, he ran into a maintenance man that worked in their neighborhood. This man told Paul that one of the property owner's family members had found Deborah's prescription bag on the sidewalk. When he handed the bag to Paul, he noticed that there was blood on it and the bag was torn. That's when Paul said he knew something was very wrong. Paul immediately headed to his mother's work, and right when she saw Paul, she asked him if he'd seen Deborah that day. Paul showed his mother the prescription bag, and that's when his mother dropped to the floor and began sobbing. That's when the police were called. They weren't able to call the police the night before to report Deborah missing because back then you had to wait at least 24 hours. Paul remembers his family, friends, and neighbors coming together to comfort the family as they waited for answers. Paul said this was the first time that anybody in their neighborhood had gone through something like this, and it was very traumatic for everyone. The day after Deborah's family reported her missing, on November 14th, two hunters driving a four-wheeler in a wooded area off Sharpville Road in Charles County, Maryland, looking for a place to hunt for deer, would come across a body lying face up under a pile of drywall about 3/4 of a mile off the road. The hunters contacted the Prince George County, Maryland Police Department to notify them that they had found a body. When the Prince George County, Maryland Police Department arrived, they realized that the remains were on the side of the creek, which was actually Charles County, Maryland, and since she was found on the south side of the creek, Prince George County contacted Charles County Sheriff's Office to take over the investigation. Deborah's family would positively identify her remains on November 16th. Paul says that his grandfather and aunt were the ones to identify her body, and they couldn't describe what they saw. It was so traumatic for them. Paul said his grandfather cried for a very long time and that this broke him. Paul says he always remembers his sister saying if anyone tried to assault her that she would fight back with everything that she had. She kept her fingernails long in case she had to fight. All of her fingernails were broken because of how hard she fought back. Deborah's official cause of death was multiple injuries as a result of force, trauma, and sharp objects. Investigators did interview Deborah's friends and families as well as the boyfriend's family. They have no solid suspects in their case, but they were able to rule out quite a few due to forensic science. Investigators say starting in the early 2000s all the way to currently now, there have been more than 40 items of evidence collected from the scene, and more than 25 of those items have either been processed, tested, or analyzed. Despite technologies and its advancements in forensic science, there has yet to be answers in Deborah's case. As more technology advancements improve, investigators will continue to test the evidence in her case. It's now been 45 years since Deborah was murdered, and her mother passed away without ever knowing who took her daughter's life. And Paul is now in his 60s, wondering how much longer he'll have to wait to see justice for his sister. He knows it won't bring her back, but it will give his family satisfaction knowing the person responsible was held accountable. Sharing these cases and telling their stories over and over again helps families get closer to that goal. Anyone with information in this case is asked to contact the Charles County Crime Solver. Thank you for taking the time to get to know about Deborah and her case today. And don't forget, when you see those missing and murdered posts on social media, hit like and share. Every time we share a face, we really do get closer to solving a case. Thank you so much for joining me for another D-State Cold Case Spotlight. And I will see you next week when we head to Rhode Island.